Live from, hang on a second, Toast. This is Austin Danger Podcast, now and forever, the only randomly curated Austin Powers podcast on the internet. I'm Kevin, as always, I'm joined by super producer extraordinaire Mackenzie Wilkes.
Hello, I have accepted the mission.
Yes, and your mission, Austin Nash, should you choose to accept it, is to join Kenzo and I as we embark on yet another journey with Brian De Palma's Mission Impossible.
Brian De Palma returns.
Yes. Brian De Palma, of course, you remember the studio took away his adaptation of James Ellroy's The Black Dahlia and smashed it into smithereens. And we tried to talk about it, one of our first episodes.
It's one of our best. Ian randomly watched that and I was like, why did you fucking watch The Black Dahlia? And they were like, I don't know. And they mentioned that the episode, the ADP episode, is an all-timer. And I'm inclined to agree. I think that's a good episode of ours.
And can I say on the subject of Ian, co-host of Mackenzo Monday, pairing? What am I looking for here? Soulmate? Duo?
Something like
that. Partner?
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
The other side of the Mackenzo Monday coin, the Criterion Connection.
Yes.
Ian last week gave their Planet of the Apes rankings, and I was quite surprised by some of it.
They liked the Burton one. They were really advocating for the Burton Planet of the Apes.
I highly suggest folks go check out the Criterion Connection episode. It's before the Love Lies Bleeding spoilers, so that's great
news.
Which
you can skip,
And the defense of the Tim Burton Planet of the Apes, unexpected, delightful, made me excited for whenever we cover that on our show.
Hell yeah. I mean, hey, same.
I mean, the original Planet of the Apes links, so anything is possible.
Anything is possible. And we did cover the first of this new, you know, series as well.
Oh, God, yeah. See, that one...
We, like, just did that.
It's hard to remember that movie exists, even though I actually really enjoy it. So, I don't know. Kevzo. I want to hear about what you've been watching. This is another thing I learned from listening to the Criterion Connection, which I admit I don't do every week. It's not personal. It's just
totally
life.
Fine. Right? Yeah, same. I barely listen to any podcasts anymore.
So I don't want to overlap with what you've been watching.
Okay.
I felt rude. I felt like I took away from the Criterion Connection with our Love Lies Bleeding chip.
No, not at all.
I'll be real. So with that in mind, Mackenzie, please, what have you brought to this show?
Gosh, I actually watched quite a few things this week that I feel like are very like Kev in the Kev bucket that like I feel like I should share. I mean, super quickly, you commented on it, but A Fish in the Bathtub, I do think you would like that movie. If only for Jerry Stiller and Ann Mira are just fantastic
man.
In it. It's Joan Nicklin Silver. I don't know if people know her. If you don't, check her out. I mean, Crossing Delancey is an incredible rom-com that Rachel and I revisited a couple of times. She also did a film I'm looking to check out soon called Hester Street. She did one called Between the Lines that features a very young Jeff Goldblum. It's kind of like a Village Voicey, young people sleeping together and trying to write a magazine in the age of the hippies in San Francisco. And it's very, very charming. But yeah, Fish in the Bathtub is great. It's like Jerry Stiller and Ann Mira play this like couple that have been together forever. And they just fight so much that Ann Mira decides to move out into her son, Mark Ruffalo's house. And young baby faced Mark Ruffalo is trying not to cheat on his wife. So that's kind of the plot of the movie. And I wrote my review. It's not the most original story I've ever seen, but the way it's done and the actors are just so delightful that it's fun. I think you'd like it, Kev.
Noted.
I also watched Dogma out of nowhere.
Yeah. So this, folks, for those of you who don't know, I am on a Kevin Smith journey that is at best slow paced. And I've been putting off Dogma. There's a 4K version on YouTube. I shudder to even mention, actually, you know what? Because this guy's kind of a recurring character on our show. I think we can say his name. Harvey Weinstein currently owns the rights to Dogma. And when he dies in prison, the rights will also be with him. And it doesn't like, and Kevin Smith has gone out of his way to try to get the Dogma rights.
Yeah.
Just because who's really making money off of it? A and B, like he has said that he's in a position to try and make money off of it. And it's kind of the last thing of the View Askew era that like
doesn't
you
have
can't
a release
get widely, right? Like Clerks, Disney puts that out all the time. Mallrats has a 4K through Arrow. Jay and Bob, perhaps, who could say. Kevin Smith owns that one, so who knows. But my point is, it's rarely seen, and it's on YouTube, and I've been putting it off forever. So my surprise, I was shocked to see the log come through from Mackenzie Wilkes for Dogma. What led you to this?
There's a YouTuber I've been watching recently named Evasive, and her thing has been, I show blank person in the queer community generally this movie. So for example, she did I Showed Non-Binary People It's Pat, that movie, or like I Showed Gay Men I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry. Like, that's like, she grabs a group and makes them watch a famously bad movie that kind of tries to represent that community. And then she did a Chasing Amy one. Is that what you're going to point out? Yeah.
Yeah. I'm on the YouTube page right now, and that's like the newest video.
Yeah. So she did a Chasing Amy one. Rachel and I famously like Chasing Amy. It's one of our most controversial opinions as queer women. And, you know, I think that Evasive's guests also did not, you know, they had what I would call the typical reaction towards the film, of just disliking it and thinking it's whatever. But I really appreciated that Evasive actually put a lot of nuance into it, because she structures the show around her kind of investigating the background of the film. And I think she correctly identifies that Chasing Amy is not about a man turning a lesbian. It is about a man's sexual insecurity. And it's about Kevin Smith's own sexual insecurity.
Exactly.
And, yeah. And exactly. So, like, I just think it's an interesting, more nuanced film than people give it credit for. I also happen to think it's very funny. I like Chasing Amy. We were thinking about rewatching Chasing Amy. Rachel was like, put it on right the fuck now after we watched this video. And I don't know why. I was just like, well, I've never seen Dogma, because I think Dogma also came up in that video for some reason. And I was like, well, it's on YouTube. Why don't we just watch Dogma, because we've never seen that one. And there we go. That's how Dogma happened. And yeah, I liked it a lot. Like, I mean, I love how kind of fantastical it is. I do find it charming. I think the Matt and Ben of it all is very funny. You know, it gets kind of grotesque near the end in a way that's interesting. Mm-hmm. I was like teetering to 4 stars with it, because I genuinely think it's really good, and I might get there eventually. You know, like most Kevin Smith films, and I don't even mean this negatively, because it is what I think works about Chasing Amy, is that it's so personal. And this obviously feels very personal. I think I read he was raised Catholic, which completely makes sense with Dogma. You know, it's a lot of these monologues that these characters have at each other feel like Kevin Smith expressing opinions about the Catholic Church that are very, very personal to him. And like, he makes these characters who are minorities, like a black man or a woman, be like, why is everybody in the Bible white? Or why is all men? You know, these aren't original arguments, I think, levied towards the Bible and Christianity, but he has them. He has these feelings, and I respect that he just kind of wanted to express them. And I was teetering to 4, but like, I did think that the monologues got a little repetitive by the end. By the time we're with Matt and Ben in the parking lot, I'm like, I get it. Let's keep moving, man. I did give it a big fat heart, though. I wasn't really sure where to land on it, but I did like it. I don't really have anger or ire against the work of Kevin Smith, because if anything, the 3 I've seen, I actually like so much. I love Jersey Girl, which everyone knows. I love Chasing Amy, and I really liked Dogma. So, like, I actually, the 3 I've seen of his, I enjoy.
I think the thing that makes him so polarizing, and the thing that people often don't see, is that this is just him spilling his guts. Right.
Yes.
Like, Clerks was a full expression of how he felt about his world at that time.
Yeah.
Right. Now, you could levy, I think, Mallrats, you can come at and say, well, the theatrical version, which is the only one I've seen, hands up here, I haven't seen it, the director's cut. But it's like, Mallrats, the version that came out, felt like the Walmart version of Clerks. Mm. But besides that, it's all pretty much him. You could even tell, like, when he's super depressed, like, you could tell. Zach and Miri comes out, he becomes super depressed, he gets addicted to weed, and then the road to Tusk begins. And you could see the culmination of all of that depression on the screen in Tusk, which is, in my opinion, a great movie that becomes miserable and unwatchable by the end. But that's a whole other story, future episode. Mackenzie, what were you going to say?
Oh, no, I was just going to say, like, I think Patrick Willems might have mentioned this in his great Kevin Smith video, but like, he's not necessarily a good director. Right. He's not someone I look to for like story composition or like beautiful visuals or like, yeah, but like, I do think that he is a personal writer and he likes making movies with his friends. And so while he is not, you know, an auteur of a certain level, I do find him to be an interesting specimen to examine. And I do respect the heart and personality he infuses into his work. And yeah, he's an interesting bird. I liked Dogma and I liked Chasing Amy.
Hell yeah.
God, there's so much. I watched so much shit this week. Finally, look at me. Watch Lisa Frankenstein. Feels very ADP core.
Yeah, very ADP core.
Yeah. Diablo Cody writes, Zelda Williams, daughter of Robin, directs. I gave it 3 stars and a big fat heart. I wrote it some good old fashioned fun because that's exactly what I think it is. I think it, while story wise, doesn't go quite as far as I would like it to in one direction or another. It's kind of trying to blend the Heathers, dark 80s, you know, dark comedy from the 80s with a kind of traditional romance rom com with a murder horror movie, like an axe murderer horror film. And while all of these aspects of it are fun, it doesn't quite go enough in one direction for me to really feel like it feels tight enough. I kind of wished it was further in the horror realm. I wish it was further in the like axe murderer horror realm. Like I wanted more death. I wanted more gore to pair with the girly 80s aesthetic. I just kind of, and if you watch it, you'll know, I don't want to say anything to spoil, but when you watch it, maybe you'll also see what I'm talking about. I wish it went a little further with the whole like horror angle, max murderer angle than it did, but it's still super fun. Diablo Cody is a funny writer. You know, I rewatched Juno out of my haze of being like 12 and being obsessed with it and still found it to be quite fun. I like the way I think that maybe some of the issues with the tone and the pacing lie in the directing, but this is Zelda Williams's first movie ever. So like, that's what happens when it's your first time ever directing a movie. And I hope she gets more opportunities to keep directing. So I think it's absolutely fun and very much worth your time. If it's something you like if you like Jennifer's Body, if you like Heathers, if you like Jawbreaker, you know, you like a good like kind of slashery horror thing, or you like movies for weird girls who want to kiss monsters, you know, things like that kind of vibe, then you will enjoy Lisa Frankenstein. I feel like I'm running out of time, so no Gone Girl talk. Maybe next week.
Oh, bummer. I have some crackerjack Gone Girl takes. Yo, so can please I bring say- it next week.
I'm saying this out loud so that maybe someone can DM me. Gone Girl, I promise that I'll throw it to you, Kev, but Gone Girl is like an extra wide film, right? The aspect ratio is like super wide, right? And like skinny. It's like different. Amazon compressed that shit and I did not know how to fix it.
Bad.
So Rachel didn't notice it, which like blew my mind, but it was driving me absolutely insane the entire watch. And so maybe that's why I didn't quite rate it as high as many other people do, but like it was so compressed. So if anyone knows how to specifically for Gone Girl on a Samsung 4K TV make that compression not happen for Gone Girl, let me know. Worst case or best case, I'll just buy a fucking Blu-ray and I'll watch it that way. But that was so irritating. Call out, this is a call out post for Amazon and how they present Gone Girl on my television.
Did Neil Patrick Harris look like Slender Man?
It's so weird watching him play straight. Not to be like that person, but I'm like, I just like, yeah. And I know that he's famous for playing a straight character on How I Met Your Mother, but I just think of him as a sweet gay man with his husband and his twins in New York City brownstones. So it's like very funny seeing him play like a smarmy straight incel kind of like that's such a wild shift for him.
It's interesting he doesn't play that more. And you know who else is in Gone Girl?
Ben Affleck.
Katie Coon.
Katie Coon.
Katie Coon.
That's like the first thing I've seen her in, I think, really. Because I don't watch Gilded Age.
I don't remember her. I had a really bad time clocking Katie Coon.
Katie Coon.
For some reason. Not her fault, but...
I love how I went to Ben Affleck immediately because he's also in Dogma and he's now my top watched actor of the year on Letterboxd, which is fucking hilarious because of This Is Me Now, A Love Story, and This Is Me Now, the documentary, Dogma and Gone Girl. So now he's one of my top actors of the year, which is very funny.
Oh, God.
I should just lean in and make Ben Affleck my number one. Why not? I'll watch Jiggly. Jiggly? What's it? How do you say it?
Gigli future episode.
I always thought it was Jiggly when I was little. I just thought it was called Jiggly.
Jai Lai.
Kev, I don't think you watched Jai Lai. What did you watch this week?
You know, I was almost going to, but then I think I had to do Dune Pod homework or something. But the homework was Total Recall, which is an awesome movie, but I don't really want to talk about here because we'll have Brandon Ulrich on and we'll do that whole thing some other time. It'll be awesome. The poor guy. I hope you're still on the road after hearing that. But the movie I want to talk about is last week on the show, off the air, and then a little bit on the air. It's like throughout, like a rotten vein. I really hated on this Beetlejuice 2 trailer, the teaser for Beetlejuice 2.
Yes.
I was upset because of some other things, and I really took it out on Beetlejuice 2. And nowhere else in my week was that more evident than in the Dolby Theater Sunday afternoon. You see, I wasn't going to go see Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, but then, like, you know, the Grugrux Dave 4-star rating came in. And then someone else's, I think Ron's rating came in. And I was like, you know, I have a feeling about this. When Ghostbusters Afterlife came out, I was like, this movie isn't like great, but I'm having such an awesome time. And so in the end, it really didn't matter, right? Because, and I'm going to apply this to Beetlejuice 2 going forward. These movies, who even cares? Like, are we really thinking about them like that? Ghostbusters, Frozen Empire?
I saw your review come in. I was sitting on the couch reading my through my little letterbox, like the afternoon paper. And I saw that review. That's 4 stars hit. Do you still have it at 4 stars? Is that where it's at?
I do, yeah. Yeah. I mean, objectively, for most people, it's going to be 3. Maybe like super fans would say 3.5, but go ahead.
But, you know, I saw that 4-star review came in, and I just chuckled to myself. And, and Rachel said, what? And I flipped the phone over. I said, to the man angry at Beetlejuice 2.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right.
Like, I giggled to myself, and it made me happy. That's not to drag you, but it did. The irony was not lost on me.
No, shit out of me for this, because I'm sitting there watching it. And it's like there's all these storylines, right? So, folks, for those of you who don't know, this is Gil Kenan's directorial debut. He's the co-writer of this film, and he co-wrote Afterlife with the director of that film, Jason Reitman, who is producing and still shepherding the franchise through a storm led by children on the internet who don't even exist. So this is still the story of Egon's granddaughter and, of course, his daughter, played by Katie Coon, who's the star of this episode. And Paul Rudd, of course, kind of playing himself. They're here in New York, baby. And it's a beautiful thing, even though they didn't shoot a lick of it in New York, very clearly.
Love it. Love that.
And it is a 2-hour smorgasbord of just absolute mess plot. There's 10 different plots that all kind of wind around, and they do resolve pretty neatly. The ones that resolve kind of neatly, in a way that's like pleasing to you if you are into this kind of thing. I did not think, for example, if I were writing for Film Comment, right, the magazine that Lincoln Center's Film at Lincoln Center puts it out, or some kind of big magazine or a big newspaper like the New York Times, I would not have given this movie a super positive review. But as a man who likes to see a ghost get busted, I thought it was a lot of fun.
Busted makes you feel good, Kev. You can't help it.
Busted makes me feel good. It actually, I'll say this, I'll open this up to a discussion because it made me resent having to rate the movie or feeling like I needed to rate the movie because, like, I had as good a time at Ghostbusters 4 or whatever this, Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, as I am going to on Friday when I see Godzilla X Kong New Empire, as much as Rise of the Planet of the Apes, for example, which is also not like a great movie and a little overstuffed. Like, I don't know. Like,
I think,
but are these movies as good? Like, are these movies as good as like a Martin Scorsese 3.5, 4-star? Fuck no, dude.
I definitely think that, like, I feel this a lot, like, so much, especially when I will watch something like, I'm trying to think of an example where I watch something that's really famous. Like, I watched Breathless, Godard, and gave it 2 stars because I didn't like it. I don't like Godard so far. And then I'll watch something like Debs immediately after, give it 5 stars. And I know that anyone who is a serious cinephile would look at that and probably be like, well, this person's an idiot. But, like, I, you know, sometimes I feel like I rate, quote unquote, objectively, like, I think this is objectively this. But most of the time, yeah, it's subjective. It's our opinions and we're not professional reviewers. And so sometimes I'm like, yeah, like, I don't try to compare Ghostbusters Frozen Empire to The Wolf of Wall Street. Like, I'm not going to put those in the same, with the same scale, because they're just different. And I think that this also proves to me that the theater experience is so important. There was that report that came out recently about how like 2/3 of people don't like seeing movies in theaters anymore. And only recently have I really learned for myself that like, I do think it's so necessary. I know I'm kind of late to the party, but Rachel and I were just talking about it. Seeing Key Largo, the Bogey movie, the Bogart Bacall, Edward G. Robinson film, in a movie theater, that was a 5-star experience. And I don't know if I would have been 5 stars like I am for that movie had I been watching it at home by myself, you know? And right. Like, I'm sure that's how it feels to be at something like Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. It's scratching a specific itch. You have a great time sitting in a Dolby theater. Why not give it 4 stars? So like, I don't know. I feel like there's... I mean, hell, I still have Marry Me at 5 stars because I had a great time at the movies.
Right.
That movie is a 2-star movie. When we do it on this show, I'll probably give it 2.5 stars, but it's a 5-star experience. I think that's, I think that's a totally valid thing to rate something on. Slim,
I think that's fair.
That new Godzilla versus Kong a 5-star because he had a great experience with the sun. Like, that's what it's about.
Well, yeah, that's how we go to movies. That's exactly right. So in between seeing the movie and now, that came out and I've just been chewing on it. And I think for me, when I rate a movie, first of all, I never assume this is for an audience. This is just my own internal, I'll call it a mental illness. like, I'm like, am I being fair to this? Like, it's not with any ego, right? This is just for my own craziness for myself. I'm rating it by the potential.
Yeah.
Right? Like, Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny is like 3, 3.5. It's a little hammy. But I really enjoy it, and they take some risks in that one that I'm still comfortable a year later with a 4-star rating on that.
There you go.
Like, it's all about who you are. And for me, I'm the kind of guy who's going to give Ghostbusters 4 stars. You may not be, listeners. I'm just telling you right now. You may be like Bill Murray, checked out. Checked out of the film.
Got that check, though.
But he got that check. Just like you can almost see her off frame submitting it in her mobile app, Kitty Coon. I will say I found her so charming.
She gets on Bank of America app. She puts that check right in her bank account. She calls Tracy Letts and she says, babe, order 50 more Blu-rays. It's on me. And then just shuts that phone down.
What do you think Tracy Letts got in the Arrow sale?
These are the questions. We need a Tracy Letts physical media podcast where each week he just tells us what he bought that week.
My God, the minutes too. I need Tracy Letts to do like a fiery play about collecting DVDs.
I am like waiting for him to be on Big Picture with Sean and just talking about Blu-rays nonstop.
I'm waiting to get him on Austin Danger podcast.
Tracy
Letts. Will be moving into plays in June, so there will be precedent.
Oh my gosh, we do August Osage County.
Oh baby. This is the sauce.
And Bug. Oh my God. Can you imagine? Y'all, I went through a major Tracy Letts phase in like early college, late high school. Yeah. Yo, my friend. Okay. Can I say a very hilariously embarrassing, but not for me, story about Bug, the Tracy Letts play?
Do it.
If you don't know what this is about, y'all, it's about these like two people in a hotel room and they are convinced the government is after them and eventually they start to hallucinate bugs on their skin. It's a whole, it's just basically people falling into schizophrenia. At one point, these characters get completely nude in the play because they are like, oh, the bugs are all over our skin. So they get naked and they spend a large portion of the play naked. And I know we're all adults here and genitalia is genitalia, but one time, the only time I've ever seen the play Bug was my friend had a DVD of her boyfriend performing it on stage, and it's like the shittiest camcorder in the back of the theater you've ever seen. And there was the chunk where like for 30 minutes I was just watching my friend's nude boyfriend in Bug, and I was just like, I'm just looking at your boyfriend's penis. This feels really weird. Anyway, Tracy Letts, come talk about Bug on our podcast.
Can we somehow, wouldn't it be so funny, by the way, if like that was my inroad into the playwriting scene in New York, is Tracy Letts on Austin Danger podcast?
That'd be the greatest thing in the entire world.
Of all things. Anyway.
Well, speaking of my friend's boyfriend's penis.
You
Whooped it news. What does it all mean, Basil?
Okay, it's time for Austin News. This is the segment every week where we give you all of the news in the world. The groovy, shagadelic world of Austin Powers, baby. Yeah. And there's no shagadelic news in the world of Austin Powers, baby. As it turns out, news for this franchise is slow.
Who would have thunk?
We do have a couple of items of Austin Danger podcast news that's very exciting. Number one, Mackenzie, you were on Movie Night Extravaganza, our friend Conan Neutron and his pals, to talk about Birds of Prey. I got it. Is it the Fantabulous Emancipation of Harley Quinn? What is it?
Yes, Fantabulous is definitely in there, and so it was
Emancipation. The Cantrabulous Fabtraptions of Professor Horatio Huffnagel of Harley Quinn. A wonderful film from about 4 years ago, desperately needs reviewing by one of the hosts of Austin Danger podcast. So I'll be doing that, and then I'll be checking out the pod. Very excited.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah.
And then, okay, if you're a real, real, real one and listening to this as it's going up to this afternoon.
Yeah.
At like 3 Eastern, I'm going to be on Escape Hatch to talk about Robert Rodriguez's direction of a James Cameron production of Alita Battle Angel. This is my first Escape Hatch. I'm on every week in the Kev's Questions, but I haven't guested on there since Elvis, like a year and a half ago. So very excited for my big return. We love those guys. They were on for Avatar, and H was on for Pee-wee's Big Adventure. We've been talking to Escape Hatch about a return, hopefully this year. Stay tuned.
We got something exciting on the docket if it ends up happening.
I have some ideas about them, but we'll get there when we get there. All of this to say, that episode of Escape Hatch, again, me, H, and Jason talking Alita Battle Angel, will be going up Sunday night. So, the math of this is killing me. this coming Sunday. So stay tuned for that. It's going to be really fun. We'll plug it again next week.
Hell yeah.
Oh, man. See, Austin Butler got cast in the the new Aronofsky film, by the way.
Oh yes. Ooh. I did. Funny how our man stays booked and fucking busy. Funny how his skin is clear and his bank account is full and he is booked and fucking busy, and we've been there from the beginning.
They keep asking me to be in movies and I keep saying yes. So that's me. I was on a horse in a Quentin Tarantino movie once, so whew. Mama be proud.
I feel like he's our unofficial mascot, Austin Butler. I do love him.
It's a great bracket to be a part of, I will say. Masters of the Air, by the way, was wonderful all the way through and got even better. Like it kind of starts a little dry, but gets amazing. So folks should check it out. And Austin is wonderful in it. So
hell yeah. Hell yeah.
Okay, I've totally drained the first half of this show for all it's worth. Mackenzie, it is time for the main event of the evening. Bring us into your wheel spin of the week, Brian De Palma's Mission Impossible.
After a successful mission, Ethan Hunt and his team of IMF agents are reunited with their boss, Jim Phelps, to travel to Prague and stop a rogue agent from stealing the CIA NOC list, which is basically a list that would expose any working spies in the organization. Unfortunately for Ethan, the mission was sabotaged from the start, and his companions, including Phelps, are killed one by one, leaving him as the sole survivor. Matters only worsen when IMF Director Kittredge reveals that the entire mission's purpose was to root out a mole and that Ethan is now the prime target. Ethan escapes and makes it to the safe house where he learns he isn't the sole survivor. Phelps' wife Claire survived as well when he told her to run away. Ethan doesn't exactly buy it at first, but sexual tension can make any man forget his doubts, and so he allows her to stay and help him. He makes contact with Max, an arms dealer who the mole was working with, and makes a deal with her. He'll procure the real NOC list, not the fake from the mission, and in return, she'll produce the mole. Ethan recruits former IMF agents Luther Stickle and Franz Krieger to help him infiltrate the CIA headquarters, and while they hit a few hiccups, they're ultimately successful in an incredibly iconic scene. IMF falsely arrests Ethan's family in order to drive him out of hiding, so he contacts Kittredge from a payphone to intentionally lure him to London. While making that call, Phelps appears and reveals himself to have survived his assassination attempt and tells Ethan that Kittredge is the mole. Too bad for Phelps that Ethan already noticed a stamp connecting Phillips to a Bible in the safe house that is in turn connected to the mole's code name, hinting to Ethan that Phelps is indeed the mole. And finally, Phelps, Ethan, Max, and Kittredge are all on a high-speed train under different circumstances, all playing into Ethan's plan to expose Phelps as a traitor, prove his innocence to Kittredge while returning the NOC list and arresting Max. And, well, all of that pretty much happens. Seems like Ethan Hunt really could accomplish the mission impossible.
Ooh.
It's a little messy. It was a little messy, but we got there. We got there.
I love it.
Well, I've never seen this movie before, obviously.
Yeah.
And we'll get into, you know, how obviously I've seen parts of it parodied time and time and time again, including some moments from my favorite movies of all time, like Charlie's Angels, just lifting complete, like, one-to-one scenes over here.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously I've been aware of the franchise because it's, I feel like it's hitting a huge stride in the modern day with crews advocating for cinema and for the franchise itself. So I'm aware of it, but never took the plunge. Kev, I think you have a more storied history with Mission Impossible.
Slightly. My first Mission Impossible was Ghost Protocol in IMAX, and it was incredible. But as a result, my view of the first three is like, and the story, and I kind of wanted to get into this in the main discussion, but like my perception of the story is skewed by coming in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And Fast and Furious is the same thing, because even though I've seen all the movies now multiple times together,
mm-hmm.
I can't help but pinpoint Fast Five and Ghost Protocol as like, I don't think Ghost Protocol is the best Mission Impossible movie, like objectively, quote unquote. I think Fast Five is the best Fast and Furious movie, but let's get rid of that discussion. But it's hard for me to not think of Ghost Protocol as the beginning because it was the beginning for me.
Mm-hmm.
So these other three movies, and especially because they've leaned into the serialization of it after three.
Mm.
So like those two feelings combined have led me to kind of deprioritize the first three, which is a shame because they're great. Like this one, I revisited it in 2020 or whenever that was, 2021. And yeah, it was just a lot of fun. And it still is a lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean, I just based on vibes of what I see on, you know, clips and things on the internet from the new ones, like this is a totally different type of vibe, it seems. This not completely, right? It's still like, you know, a spy thriller at its core, but just like visually and vibe wise it's so different, it seems, than this.
Yeah,
but I feel like part of why it looks different, and maybe this is a place to start, is Mr. Brian fucking De Palma at the helm of it.
Yeah, man.
I love it when it's, you know, it's a rarity, but I love it when these like really recognizable auteurs would take on a random franchise thing. You know, I think people in our age range think of the Cuarón Harry Potter probably as like that idea of like a true auteur stepping into a franchise, and it just kind of sticks up like a sore thumb, because I have to assume none of the other Mission Impossibles look like this, because this does, like, yes, while it is standard quote-unquote action fare in some senses, it still has that Brian De Palma flair and those visual, those kind of, I don't know, quirky, for lack of a better word, visual tics that he has. And I mean, God, the split diopter, like when I saw that, I just smiled so big because I know that's De Palma. And like, yeah, it's just such a unique feel that like obviously just action films just don't look or feel like this anymore. And Brian De Palma is, I feel like, a huge part of that.
No, that's exactly right. And I mean, I'll spoil something for you in saying that like the John Woo stuff has the style you're looking for at a John Woo in Mission Impossible 2. To the point where I think that's more of a John Woo movie than a Mission Impossible movie.
Oh.
but it's way better when you think of it like that. But then we get J.J. Abrams and Brad Bird, who give us movies that look like movies. And then it's just the same kind of style the whole time, which is great. But it's the style. It's not Brian De Palma's style.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's like action movie. It's how Mission Impossible looks. For better or for worse, you know. Do you know what I mean, though? Like,
yeah, I mean, I still feel like I felt the Palma in it, though, which is why I enjoyed it.
Oh no, this film for sure.
Yeah,
absolutely. I Want to Start Big I want to start with our major link. I want to start with the star of Austin Pussy. I want to return to him. We are returning now our second time this year to, right? Only the second time, right? Minority Report.
Yes, which LOL, this movie and Minority Report back to back. LOL.
The man is Mr. Tom Cruise. And I think I've finally cracked it. I think the one thing that sets him apart and makes him crazy is that he's playing for like the Cinerama IMAX that takes over your entire life and puts you in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
He is so extra. He's playing like that for people who watch the movie on TV. He is huge. He's like Imelda Staunton in Hello. He's like Imelda Staunton in Gypsy. If you get this reference, email austindangerpodcast@gmail.com. I want to know who you are. But Imelda Staunton as Mama Rose is playing crazy because she's playing a barn. It's a giant theater and she's playing for the person in the last row. And so is Tom. When he needs something, he needs it right now. Sorry, my girlfriend's sleeping. I'm trying to do this right. Right. He's not trying not to fall asleep. He's like blinking his eyes wide open, trying to stay awake. He's not running. He's doing whatever Tom Cruise does when he runs. He's so insane when he's trying to convey emotion in this film.
I had to count. So I was doing that while you were talking. And this is his fifth appearance on the show. I feel like he's the most featured actor, or at least one of them, other than maybe Mike himself. In our whole podcast. Member,
Jerry Maguire.
Yes.
Minority Report this week. Don't tell me the fifth one.
Okay. If I tell you, you're going to palm to your forehead.
Oh, this is embarrassing.
Do you want to?
I have no.
Do you want a hint?
Can you give me a hint?
Who wants you? Save me.
Oh, duh. Of course we did Magnolia. Yeah. Of course. Which was one of his next roles, which was a great, like, after this, Tom continues to make Mission Impossible, but then also starts doing these, like, he's back to risky dramas.
I think he's going back. It seems like he's in current day moving more back into some interesting dramas. So
I hope
let's
so.
Let's go, King. Yeah, no, I love him in this. I mean, he's that actor that, like, I try to deny that I like him, but everything I see him in, I pretty much like him. I mean, man, that man not single-handedly, but most handedly sold me on Jerry Maguire. And that's another iconic ADP ep of when we both fell in love with that movie.
People go back to the episode before Jerry Maguire, hear our reaction to getting it, and then go back and listen to the episode.
But like, I think I felt the same way in Minority Report. Like, something I enjoy about Tom is that he's able to, I think, really sell the reality and the stakes of action movies, which can sometimes feel like unreality or you know, they're heightened to when I think of some of the newer James Bond movies that I would stick a little bit of, right? They're hyper dramatic and very like just intense energy. I don't know. All I know is I think that Tom sells it, I don't know, in a way that does feel real. Like, he is insane and he's doing so much, but like, to me, it just fits the tone so well, and he is almost who's like showing me where I need to be at, you know what I mean? Like, he is making it feel like this is the most important fucking thing in the whole world, so that I as a viewer really feel that. I think, I don't know, I think he really brought me into the world, and it was kind of charming watching him in this role, seeing how young he looks, and me with the meta knowledge that he did not have in 1996, knowing that he would be playing this character in 20 more years. You know what I mean? Like, I kind of loved watching him so baby-faced and knowing that through this journey, I'll kind of watch him grow up. I kind of loved that about him. Is that weird? Then that's like, no one could have had that knowledge when they were watching it originally, but like, I can. So it kind of makes me smile.
Right.
It makes me like Ethan more because I know I get to like invest in him and like care about him and keep staying with him in his story. So I'm like, yeah, I love this guy.
Right.
But he is doing so much, but works for me totally. Speaking of great performances, Vanessa Redgrave showing up for 5 minutes and being fucking awesome. Vanessa Redgrave was great.
Out of nowhere, so awesome.
I wanted more from her. I read online that, you know, it's IMDb trivia, so no sources, obviously. But something like her character was originally written as a man, which I don't doubt. I think it works so well as a woman only because them like flirting in the car. I was like, tell me why I'm twirling my hair. What's going on? Like the sexual energy between Ethan Hunt and Max in that car. I was like, when she was like, called him a good boy or something. I was like, excuse me. I was like, going to shoot through the roof. I wanted more from that. I was like, please let Ethan and Max make out. Like, I need this cougar on Ethan Hunt right now.
Oh, my God. How did you feel about the other ensemble members? Because this is also important. Later on in the franchise, they'll curb everything in and they'll like define these people for good. But I'm wondering what you thought of everybody else.
I mean, I'm going to be real. None of them really popped out to me other than Ving Rhames, which I know he's going to be in like right. all the other movies. So I'm like, okay, I could get, yeah. I know I can get attached to this guy. And he's great. He's a great character. I see 100% why they wanted to keep that character around because he's great in even a short amount of time. But yeah, I don't know. Claire, she was kind of a nothing burger to me. Like she didn't super resonate with me. I loved Kristen Scott Thomas. I was like, I love her as an yep. actress, and then she's gone so quickly, it kind of sucks. You're like, shit, I would have loved to have her maybe in the Claire role so that she's around more, and I think she'd be a much more compelling actress. Like, truly no offense to that actress, she just didn't really bring a lot of energy or depth to that character. I saw Binoche was also offered that role, and I'm like, man, imagining Julia Binoche, and that would have been incredible. But yeah, none of the other ensemble members really leap out to me. I said this to you. I mean, the second I laid eyes on John Voight, I said, oh, the mentor, he's evil. That's it. Like
I was so proud of you. But you got it right away.
But it's like 2 seconds in. He's clearly the most evil man alive. He watches freaking what's-his-fuck get smushed by elevator, stabby ceiling things. And he has zero yeah. emotion on his face after that. And you're like, okay, well, obviously that guy's evil. But also I feel yeah. like that out of, we'll talk about it, the many things that have been riffed on in this film, in a dozen other films now. I feel like that's maybe one of them. Not that that was like never done before, but the idea of like the mentor we're supposed to trust is actually the bad guy. We get that kind of in Minority Report as well. The director is, you know, the guy he's supposed to trust, the guy who trained him is actually the bad guy. And I kind of, it's the same thing here. So while it probably didn't feel overdone when people were first seeing this, obviously it's, I've seen it a million other times now, that kind of trope, I guess, if that makes sense. So I felt like the villain just arc wise was quite uncompelling to me because I was just to me so obvious from the beginning that he wasn't dead. So then you're sitting there waiting the whole movie being like, come the fuck on, just show me what I already know. And then when it's revealed, there was not a lot of impact for me there. So like, I don't think he really for me popped as a villain in the way I want. That's why I like thought Max was much more interesting as a villain. I kind of wish she was more involved. I do know that later in the series, the villains, I think, make more of a splash from what I've heard, maybe.
Yes.
And so,
yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, that's probably honestly my biggest negative is just Phelps as a villain wasn't quite compelling to me. I understand the characters from the television show, so maybe that's why they wanted him there to kind of bring that audience through. But, like, yeah, that's my main negative is that I just didn't find the villain arc to be really interesting. And it was predictable.
Counterpoint.
Go for it.
I agree. I think those notes are accurate. And I think you're touching on another, like one of my major points for tonight, which is something that Mission Impossible has a kinship with Austin Powers, which came out the next summer,
mm-hmm.
which is like many things in the 90s. It's like our episode, Dick Tracy, like future episode, Tim Burton's Batman, like our episode, The Addams Family and The Flintstones. It's a reboot of an older thing from the 60s,
mm-hmm.
which was like a big thing at the time. And as a result, there's even like, even the cold open to me this time smacked of playing old school on purpose.
Yeah.
So then in the full movie, you could say like, sure, okay, that mask looks like oatmeal here. But later on, we're going to CG John Voight's face onto a mask for Tom, and it's going to be amazing because it's not the 60s anymore. So I think they went basic on purpose. Mm. I know that, like, I mean, look, It's a Pastiche is probably the most played Kev take on the show at this point because I've done it so much. But I do think it's on purpose, although I don't. It worked for me because of this, but also I understand how, like, Big Trouble in Little China, for example, which is also a pastiche, mm-hmm. did manage to make that fun on its own.
Yeah.
In a way that, like, that was not for you.
And it's also hard to like, it's impossible to watch this in a vacuum, right? Like, I am so aware that there is like seven more movies to be had with this series. Yeah. And so it's hard to also experience it as its own thing, I think. Because I, in my brain, I'm also thinking like, I know there's so much more to experience after this. So I have to tamper, I feel like, where I'm at in terms of like how I experience it, I guess. So maybe that's why I'm also more hyper aware of these maybe nitpicks I have for it.
And here's the mind fuck of this franchise. Is that in 3, when J.J. Abrams does MI3, it is basically the soft reboot. I don't know how Tom Cruise saw this coming, but he's turning it into the franchise you can make 5, 6, 7 of there. So here is a very purposeful 60s pastiche spy adventure that was set to stand alone.
Mm.
Like Wild Wild, you know, well, Wild Wild West has a sequel hook in it.
Yes, it does.
Google. But like my point is like this was made without any expectations. And then they did the John Woo movie. And then they made the franchise.
Mm.
And then you can see. Now, please, people, do not email. I love these films. They are all incredible, in my opinion. But 4, 5, 6, and 7 are of a mold.
Mm.
They're great. But they are a signature, especially when McQuarrie takes over on Fallout. Or I think it's Rogue Nation, and he has a trademark style and a feeling, and that's the style and the feeling.
Yeah.
And retroactively, you can see where he grabbed from JJ and Brad Bird, and it's the franchise. So I it's a mind fuck. Mm. We'll get there. but this is a totally different thing. So I can understand how those things are hard to reconcile. Here's something I'd like to admit while we're talking. Kenzo.
Yes. Kevzo.
Would you like to pop some corn?
Yeah, I got so much corn. I did think the cold open was kind of unintentionally hilarious. And maybe that's...
Oh, yeah?
Well, like when he walks in and he pulls the fucking mask off and he goes, get rid of that scum. And then he goes and saves a poor helpless lady and holds her head. And he's like, oh, so exhausted and happy that she's alive. And it's like this very like... melodrama kind of to me. Like I thought it was kind of funny, and then it's bam 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 bam, and then you're like, oh my god, this fucking rips immediately. So I kind of love that it starts with melodrama and then that theme comes in and you're just shooting through the ceiling at that point.
And then to put the fine point on it, it's a TV opening credit sequence with clips from the movie in it. Like, amazing touch.
Incredible. Did I clock correctly Leslie Manville randomly as the woman on a plane? Did you clock that? Did I clock that correctly?
No, I didn't clock it.
Well, let me just do a little Google, because I swear to Google God, the up. Woman who like brings, I forget who's on the plane in the beginning, Phelps, I think, brings Phelps like a drink. I was like, what the fuck is this?
Did you think Emilio looked like Michael Douglas in this role?
Kinda, a little bit. Okay, nothing is popping
up. A little bit, right?
So maybe I just imagined Leslie Manville in that movie, but some people go fire up your Amazon Prime, look at that woman who brings Phelps a drink in the beginning, and tell me that is not Leslie Manville. I feel like that time where the woman from Twin Peaks, when Grace Zabriskie was in Nobody Knows Anything and she wasn't credited anywhere, and I had a full meltdown about it. That's how I feel right now.
God, we may never know what role she played in that film.
We'll never know.
Stolen valor of Grace Zabriskie.
I thought it was so interesting to see the your mission if you choose to accept it, and this table self-destruct stuff being from this originally, right? Obviously, that's been referenced a million times in culture. I did not know it was from Mission Impossible, actually.
Yep.
I just kept, God, these fucking masks they have on Tom. I just, every time he had a new mask on, it was the funniest thing ever.
I think the best mask was the fact that they had the shitty mask. They had him wear the shitty mask on C-SPAN.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Was really funny, especially in 4K.
Yes.
Like, folks, if you grew up watching this on tape or you saw it in the theater or whatever, like, did the masks look like mashed potato oatmeal? Let us know.
I loved the score. Fucking Danny Elfman returns to the show. I loved that score. I thought it was really cool.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. I just like every, I just, there was so many moments where the score popped out to me in the best ways. And I, throughout the whole film, I loved it. Laughed my ass off when he just looked up max.com. I wrote the one to watch. He was going to watch a WB movie on max.com. Also the idea that like an international arms dealer that's anonymous would just have the domain max.com. They're like, this person's incognito. No one knows who they are. Let me go ahead and get this domain. That's myname.com. Anyway.
How about the Usenet alt.bible?
Yes.
Going on my favorite message board, alt.bible.blindness.
I wrote Voight married to an absolute smoke show of a woman, not believable. I wrote, when Chloe.
He's not believable in the role.
No, he's
period.
Just not well cast. I really thought this aggressive pat down was too much. And then he's like holding her down on the bed. You can't tell if they're going to fuck each other. And that was a weird moment. I was like, what's happening here? I read that there was more of a love triangle there, but then they cut it because test audiences thought it took away from the action, quote unquote. But I feel like there's still a large amount of this love triangle thing in there to where it feels a little uneven because they cut so, presumably so much of it out. You know what I mean? Because there's like moments mm-hmm. where she kisses him and it feels really loaded. And then the moments at the end where he's like, he fucked my wife, or he says something, he like acknowledges that they maybe had a flirtation. I don't think that those moments play as well because they cut so much of the relationship building out, because the tension is there from this really aggressive scene. And I was hoping the film would pick up on it. I think that would just make her death much more compelling, and it would make the whole, again, even Voight's arc a bit more compelling. So that also felt a little left on the table for me. But yeah, just wanted to mention that, I guess. I wish that love triangle was there more, because it's there, but not quite enough. It's paced like the fucking speed of light. I paused to get some water.
Yeah, man.
And it felt like 5 minutes had been 42. I was like, good Lord, this movie's flying by. Ethan Hunt describing the various ways of how they get into the vault was lifted completely on Charlie's Angels. Now I know the reference of the getting into the vault description. I thought that was really fun.
Man, wait until you see how Austin Pussy is a literal direct parody of the Mission Impossible 2 opening.
Oh, wow.
Just you wait.
The Tom saying, we're going to do it, I think. Yeah, we're gonna do it. And then the theme blasts in. It was the loudest fucking thing of all time. That's what I wrote my review about on Letterboxd. But it was an awesome moment when they used that theme. I think they used it one too many times. Like the three big times they used it, it was perfect. And then they added it at the very end. And I was like, no. I don't need it at the very end, because you already used the theme perfectly throughout the film. So they overkilled it by one. But I loved whenever the theme came in, especially that we're gonna do it into the theme. Incredible. It made me think, I bet the theme fucking rocks when they bring it in the newer ones. I bet they do these like overblown orchestral like fancy ones now, and they bring them in the new franchise, and I bet it fucking rocks. I have to imagine.
Yeah, it's pretty good. That's pretty good.
I don't remember why he said this, but at one point Ving Rhames says, "Hi there." Do you remember that?
I just
wrote Ving Rhames saying "Hi there" smiley face. So I guess that was just a great moment from Ving Rhames. I love in the iconic stealing scene, the wires on the ground, obviously he almost falls. Oh, you know, iconic scene, been referenced and redone a million times. I loved the sound design in that scene, aka the lack of sound, the silent room tone. Only maybe interrupted by the guy vomiting in the bathroom, but I thought it made it feel, the scene feels so immersive. Like you feel like you also need to be as quiet as Ethan so you don't fuck up. Like I love the lack of sound in that scene, so it felt so immersive, and it juxtaposes amazingly with the rest of the film that is filled with this very bombastic score, and then it's dead silent for like 5 minutes. I thought that was brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, my last note was just about the villain arc being kind of lackluster, and you see it from the beginning. I even called the pilot guy. I texted you. I was like, he's clearly a bad guy. Like, he just looks evil. So, like, I called the villains pretty easily, and I just wish it was less predictable.
It was great. I was away. I was in a meeting, and then I came out of the meeting to Mackenzie guessing and then feeling validated and then trying not to hide the disappointment that it was so obvious. It was awesome.
The John Voight mask was deeply hilarious, because he's sitting there not
How
talking
about the Voight mask,
and I was like, yeah, there's no way that's really John Voight. Like, there's no way. And then yeah, ripped it right off. Very funny.
I will say this, like, without giving too much away, this begins a legacy of great mask reveals.
I'm aware of that. I saw a thread recently where people were saying that it gives other actors a really exciting chance to do their best Tom Cruise mannerism or their best Ethan Hunt. And it was like a compilation of actors who have played Ethan in a mask, but that actor is playing Ethan. Does that make sense? Yeah. And
right.
I saw a compilation of that.
Because it's them until they do the effect.
Yeah. And so I thought that was fun. And the last thing I wrote was I loved the gag. It was kind of cartoonish. It felt like that maybe old school TV pastiche when he's on the thing stops unexpectedly. Oh my God, the wing's coming and it just stops in front of his neck. And then the gag of the guy, the little, like, he looks like a bellhop, but he's like the train conductor guy, seeing it and then passing out. It was very like old school pastiche to me in a way that I thought was really cute. And so, yeah, loved that moment. Kev, do you got some corn?
I don't have a ton. We've covered a lot of it. I want to say once again, alt.bible.blindness. This movie is incredible. If you can see it in 4K, they did a great job. Looks awesome. Flashlights on the glasses. Man, I could use a flashlight. My God, that would change my life. There's a great quote. We aren't in the 60s anymore. Maybe a little on the nose, but I liked the way they dealt with that. Especially versus other things. Like, I like the high camp comedy of the Brady Bunch movie, but it does hit you over the head with a shovel about what it's all about. Mm. And I think Mission Impossible did that much better. And it also became a great franchise later. So what else do I have here? Whole intro is roughly the length of a TV half hour in 1996. That's right. So from the cold open beginning of the movie to the credits is about 24 minutes, which is, you know, we're watching The Simpsons, a couple friends and I, and that's about as long as a half hour would be. Mm. I love the Bible puzzle. My last thing is, I forget the way this line was read, but I have this noted. I don't like to communicate via a shroud. The screaming of shroud was very funny to me. And that is my corn. So Kenzo, the world is waiting. I've publicly joked about this a lot, but now we have to know. What final thoughts, star rating, the world is yours.
I obviously liked this movie a lot. I had a great time. You know, I think there's sometimes, we talked about this recently, some fear and anxiety with coming back to the source, right? When you've seen something riffed on so many times, will it hold up? And while I think in many senses it does, because the performances and the tone of it are so unique to its time and its place. But I also think the detriment to that is that, yeah, the villain arc is not quite compelling and it feels overdone while it may not have at the time. And characters like Claire just aren't fleshed out or given enough of an interesting arc to make sense. So it has its issues, but it's also really, really great for the genre, I think. And I think it's hard not to love it just for how much it influenced after how many influences came on many, many other films that we love from this movie. So I think, and I'm giving it this rating because I also like, I typically don't rate franchises. And also, like, I do think I like to take them all where they're at and kind of see how I feel about them in relation to one another. If that makes sense. So I don't want to start out crazy and then have nowhere to go. So I'm going at 4 stars for Mission Impossible. Cause I think it was exceptional. I think I'm probably going to continue to think of it as a really exciting and fun movie I'll return to, but I want to give the franchise room to grow while also acknowledging that the OG is always special. Kev, give me your rating.
I stayed at 5 stars. It's just so awesome. And again, the pastiche is great. Tom's great. All the stuff that you felt disappointed by, I fall for every time and love it for what it is. It's a special thing. These first three are, again, you'll see as we go down this journey through the next 10 years worth of shows, because as the Star Wars journey has taught us, we will never finish a journey on this show ever. before four, they are all very distinct. So I'm interested to get to it.
Hell yeah.
But for now, I mean, this is an all-time classic for me.
Let's do our little show.
I love gold. At the Saturn Awards, it was nominated for Best Action Adventure Thriller Film. I should note up top, this is Isle of Gold. This is the segment where we go through the awards won by our film of the week. Mission Impossible won 3 awards and was nominated for 17 total. One of the wins, the BMI Film Music Award for Danny Elfman, the Golden Screen Award in Germany. and the PGA Award for Most Promising Producer in Theatrical Motion Pictures for Tom Cruise and his partner, Paula Wagner, who indeed did have an extremely prosperous career in producing together. At the Razzies, this film was nominated for Worst Written Film, grossing over $100 million, which...
Okay.
Specific and mean. Yeah. Really very silly. Twister won, which tells you everything you need to know. So, at the Kids' Choice Awards, Tom Cruise was nominated for Favorite Movie Actor. Check out how cursed this lineup is. First of all, Will Smith for Independence Day lost. Isn't that amazing?
LOL.
Robin Williams is nominated for Jack, a movie that creeped, the beginning of it creeped me out so much as a kid, I made my dad like bring us home. Like I left 5 minutes into Jack.
Oh my God.
Jack is a Francis Ford Coppola movie about a boy that ages too fast or something. It's one of the worst movies ever made. Like I'd like to think that even then I had a radar for real shitty movies. So I feel good about that. And the winner is Jim Carrey for The Cable Guy, which is not a movie I would describe as being for children.
No, based on what I know. Yeah.
No. Finally, at the MTV Movie and TV Awards, 1997 award for Best Action Sequence, but lost to Twister for The Truck.
Wow.
Driving through the farm equipment. And they lost to like The Rock and Eraser and the aliens blowing up the White House on Independence Day.
That's wild.
I can't imagine not being impressed by that. That's so wild to me.
Is Independence Day's direct connection that there's just a clip in Austin?
I mean, that's, I'm sure that there's like Malcolm McNabb too. Like
yes.
Pat Romano, et cetera. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Speaking of all those people, it's time for the Alan Parsons Project. This is the segment where we link our film of the week to the Austin Powers trilogy. And of course, I mean, Tom Cruise, right? Of course.
It's him. He's Austin Pussy.
It's him. But also, check this out. Some regular friends. Keith Campbell, Bobby Page, George Dering, Rick Baptist, Luis DiTullio.
Luis, the queen.
George Dering. Hall of Famers.
If only, okay? I hope this, I need... One day I need to let these people know we love them so much. Like
every time I hear a flute now, I'm like, what if?
It's Luis. Trumpet, it's
like, and
it's Malcolm.
It's gotta be Malks.
It's old Malky.
Gotta be my boy Malks. God, we gotta reach out to these people. You know what I mean? I wanna say also Alan Kaplan in the music department, credited for Alita Battle Angel. So we will be doing an episode on that one day.
Oh,
a long time from now because of the Escape Hatch episode, but we'll do it one day, as well as the Tomorrow War and Wish and all these wonderful movies. He played trombone on a special called J.C. Bring Cutting to the Truth, which is a documentary about one of the victims of the Charlie Manson murders.
Jesus Christ.
Sebring was a friend of Sharon Tate, you understand, and it was a whole thing. So we'll do that one day, and that'll be fun.
Jesus
Christ. And that is but some of the 30 or so names that bring us this film, and we thank all of them equally. They are all wonderful, hardworking people. As the Flaming Lips once said, they're just humans with wives and children. There you are. You're over there.
There are no yous over there, but if you would like to be over there, you can send us a letter or a voicemail at austindangerpodcast@gmail.com and we will share it on the show, my loves. That's it. I went short.
Is that your Animal Crossing Villager catchphrase? My loves?
My loves? I called Rachel Angel recently and it just shot out of me and I didn't mean to do that. And I was like, Rachel, gonna be real. Don't know where that came from. I was like, hey, are you okay, Angel? And like, never called anyone Angel in my fucking life. Like, where did that come from? And now I'm saying my loves?
Oh, boy.
Who am I? But yeah, I don't know why I'm speaking this way recently. It's weird. I don't know.
It's funny. I think that was very funny.
But as I was saying, my loves, you can send us letters, voicemails, austindangerpodcast@gmail.com. Boom. Kev?
Yep.
We got to spin the wheel. It's the whole show. It's the whole damn thing. Trying to explain that to people on Movie Night Extravaganza of like what our show even is. It's like, it's, you just got to listen. Just if you see a movie you like, just listen to it.
Yeah. I mean, we're just like any other podcast, except that we are randomly curated. Case in point, I am now about to spin our beautiful wheel. What will be the 108th episode of Austin Danger Podcast? Kenzo, this is a weird one for us. Okay. It is distinctly out of wheelhouse. In fact, I would argue it's much more in Escape Hatch's wheelhouse than ours.
Oh.
It is the beginning of a journey. It is a parallel journey to another we are already on. Just a week ago, Ian said that this was their like fourth favorite film in a certain franchise. So, look, I spun the wheel and it landed on this. I'm considering it a gift. I promise everybody this is absolutely real. I spun the wheel and it came up. There's really nothing I can do. You're going to have to believe me.
I'm sitting in utter confusion.
Next week on Austin Danger Podcast, we will be traveling far beyond the stars. Far beyond time and space as perceived, and it will be crash landing with Charlton Heston on the Planet of the Apes.
OG?
1968.
Oh, shit.
We are doing the original Planet of the Apes next week on Austin Danger Podcast. Yes, really. I promise you it's real. This is 100% real. There's a lot of ape talk recently. Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is weeks away, so what better way to celebrate?
Holy shit.
Yeah, no joke. I also flipped out.
I know the vibe, but I've never seen it. So
I was creeped out, honestly. But you know what? I'll take it because it's on the mind. Because Ian, this whole journey Ian's been on has had my mind reeling. So I'm so excited to get back into it.
Hell yeah. I mean, let's fucking do it. Let's fucking go. Wow, this poster on Letterboxd rips. It's so late 60s in the best way.
All of the OG posters are incredible. They're all really amazing. How about this inset headshot of Dr. Zaius? Is Dr. Zaius doing a one-man show at Minetta Lane? Like, what is he doing? What is this? Did he rent Barrow Street for 3 weeks? What is this headshot?
The name Dr. Zaius. Wow.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you have no idea. Yeah. Have you? You've seen it,
no,
right?
I don't know anything about Planet of the Apes. I watched the one we watched a couple months ago. I know nothing about Planet of the Damn Apes.
Next week on Austin Danger Podcast, whatever the hell's going to happen here, Planet of the Apes, 1968, Charlton Heston. Folks, this movie, I'm so sorry, everybody. I know I feel like I say it every week, but it's true. You're going to want to watch it if you haven't seen it. Come check it out. Coming out with us. Peace and love. I'm warning you with peace and love. It's going to be special. But until then, from Mackenzie, this is Kev. Austin Danger Podcast, peace!
If you want to find us on social media, you can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd at Austin Danger Pod. This episode was mixed and edited by me, Mackenzie. Thanks for listening.